What's going on, everyone? Welcome back to a very special video by Ramblings of a Sikh. As I'm getting set up, let me introduce you to our location today, Hampton Court Palace. It's here that everything started. In the aftermath of World War I, around 1,800 members of the Indian Army made their temporary home here, marking their involvement in the post-war peace celebrations. This notable chapter from the past is being rekindled right where it unfolded through the exhibition, The Indian Army at the Palace. The exhibition explores the soldiers' living conditions and personal journeys while also shining a light on the wider social-political context of the time. Through a rich array of never-before-seen artifacts, photographs and personal narratives, the exhibition provides a window into the past and to appreciate the indelible imprint they left on the historical record of Hampton Court Palace. Now, I'm here today to record a super exciting behind-the-scenes video of the exhibition covering each part of it, diving into the stories of some of the artifacts and getting to know more about what it took to put something like this together. Level 2 YouTube members or higher, you should have instant access to it now. Everyone else, you'll get to watch that in the next couple of weeks, so make sure to subscribe as not to miss out. However, today I'm joined by Rao Singh and Tejpal Singh, two of the organisers behind this exhibition, who will help guide us through these stories, further providing a tantalising insight into the exhibition that will hopefully interest and intrigue you enough to go to Hampton Court Palace to experience it yourself. What I want to start with for this exhibition is, why is Hampton Court Palace so important as a location for where these people were resting or situated?
So Hampton Court is a site for Sikh history, so it's quite an interesting one because Hampton Court is what's termed a historic royal palace. Okay. So it's historic in that there's no royal family that live there today. It's not a resident.
Okay, yeah.
So it's a historic palace, you know. So Hampton Court is associated largely, all the visitors, anyone who goes there, it's because it's a Tudor palace built in 1515, right? So, and when we look from a Sikh perspective, Guru Nanak was on the Dhrti at 1515. Yeah. The yatras around the world, you know, and the Udassis. So 1515, so the palace is as old as Sikhi, you know. Sikhi was probably just 15 years young at that time.
And you said Tudors.
Tudors.
Like, so which king?
King Henry VIII.
Built it?
King Henry VIII didn't build it. So his cardinal, it was the residence of his cardinal. Then obviously he had a falling out with his cardinal. Yeah. The cardinal moves on and he takes over the palace.
Fine. Okay. Yeah. So from Henry VIII's time.
Henry VIII's time. So every visitor comes to Hampton Court because of King Henry VIII. It's about banquets, kitchens, parties, the palace. It's on the River Thames, boats, etc. And literally, it was probably 4 years ago that Tej has been telling me about Hampton Court Palace. And we've been working on the tours together. And Tej has said to me, Rav, there is a lot of history around Hampton. So really, that history started with Sophia for me. You know, Sophia, the Leap Singh, had a grace and favour apartment at Hampton Court Palace.
And you say grace and favour, what does that mean?
So her father's passed away, the Leap Singh's passed away. She's a godchild of Queen Victoria. Queen Victoria then gives her a grace and favour apartment on the estate for her London residence. So she did spend a lot of time, all of her London residence, that's her flat.
And I'm assuming this is before she becomes, like, she's heavily involved in being a suffragette, or is this at the...
No, during the suffragette time.
So hold on. We can't skip over a fact like that. So you're telling me she's a suffragette at the same time she's living in a building that is essentially given to her by the Queen?
Exactly. And that's why she was such a prominent suffragette, because of her royal family connection. So I think she was like weaved into the suffragette movement so that it would gain media attention.
Do you think without her royal, like without the Queen's backing, so to speak, I know she's not literally supporting her, but as in giving her a house is a pretty decent way of supporting someone. Do you think if she didn't have that, she would have been as influential as a suffragette as she was?
Probably not in the media. Because
okay.
When a princess who has a grace and favour apartment, Queen Victoria died in 1901. So King Edward, and you know, he's talking to his minister saying, look, she's causing all this embarrassment to us. What can we do about her? But they can't kick her out of her grace and favour apartment because Queen Victoria had bestowed that upon her. You know, so there's letters at the British Library, you know, about what do we do with this woman?
This woman who's
going around causing all this havoc, you know, according to the government. So that was one part of the history. And then Tej told me about all the rest of the history, which is, I'll let you carry on here, about based on the coronation camps.
Yeah, well, just coming back to maybe why Hampton Court Palace was chosen. Mm. I've come across a few articles in some newspapers. Originally, it was going to be Old Deer Park, which is not that far. It's in Richmond. Okay. And a decision has been made just before the 1902 camp. Yeah. that they're going to use Hampton Court. Well, they're going to use Home Park. Okay. Home Park, which is right next to Hampton Court Palace. Yeah. And one point it was all part of the same grounds. Oh, okay. And we think Hampton Court Palace was chosen for the Indian Army contingent because there's many other colonial contingents from the West Indies or parts of Africa, Australia, New Zealand. If, for example, in Alexandra Palace or other parts of London. So Hampton Court Palace was chosen, I think, partly because it's the closest part of London, if you like, to Southampton. Yeah. So it's the first palace you come up to if you travel up from Southampton. Oh, so it was
kind of like on the route, so to speak.
On the route.
Yeah.
Secondly, they had the space in the grounds. And thirdly, they had the means to get into central London quite easily. So you've got a train station, plus you've got on the Thames. So it was quite strategically located.
So it was actually picked for its practical use rather than because it was a palace per se.
For such a large contingent.
Yeah. So as in, I guess if there was a hotel at that point that was big enough, they may have put them in that. But it's actually just the fact that you need a building that can support so many people and everything that goes with it, the food, the bedding, the rest of it.
Well, you mentioned a hotel, but you've got to remember, if you've got cavalry coming, you need space for the horses.
Okay, good point. Yeah. Couple horses in a hotel. Fair.
Exactly. So, okay. Because they bought everyone, you know, everything came.
So it wasn't just physically the people, it was actually like, as in, so let me rephrase this. The soldiers that were stationed there were stationed as though they would be, if they were out going to war then, I'm guessing. Like, as in they're coming in there,
the camp.
Full regalia and with all of the goods.
Indeed, including camp followers, or you could say non-combatants.
So like chefs, cooks, washers.
Exactly.
Dobbies, dadgies.
Barbers, every regiment bought their own. So it wasn't just one cook for everyone. One cook per unit. One cook per regiment.
Multiple kitchens, multiple laundries.
And I don't know if it's as segregated at this point, but would you also have different chefs for different, like halal, non-halal?
Yes, you would.
You would have this. Yes. Okay.
There's actually images of, in Urdu it's written like, Langar Khana Musliman, like in Urdu, like we've got it translated. And it's like a shed where they're cooking for certain communities.
So going back to Hampton Court, then when Tej started saying to me, you know, Rab, we can create a tour around.
Yeah.
We had Safiya's house, we had the coronation camps, we had Home Park. We knew these stories. But when we curate these tours, we kind of link them to tangible items.
Yeah.
So you see this, and this is the story behind it. That's how we do our London tours. So I was kind of hiring with Tej. I was thinking, yeah, but it's all storytelling in locations. There's nothing to prove.
This is
Safiya was here. The stamp then came out from the Royal Mail.
So does the building that she lived in, does that still exist in the way it was then?
Exactly, as it is. And now it's got a blue plaque on there saying Princess Safiya the Leaping Lived
And
here.
So that's the building that
Faraday
Nunn.
House, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And Peter Band.
And is that near to Hampton?
Across the road.
It's just across the road.
So it was part of the estate in the old days.
Okay.
And there was a fence.
Okay.
And at that fence, she came out of bed one day, she put a mink coat on, given to her by Queen Victoria, sat outside.
Stylish woman.
Stood outside Hampton Court Palace and sold the Suffragette magazine for women's rights. And that's what memorialised on the UK stamp.
That's pretty insane. Wow. Oh, and so that's that photo that she's where she's holding the...
Yes, right. We've located that exact location.
So if you go into Hampton Court Palace, that's the main entrance.
That she stood out in front.
Yeah, they built a wall after.
Oh, wow.
It was just a fence and the estate just carried on.
That changes the whole kind of impact of that image because she's not just stood on a random road, right? She's stood in front of a royal palace and basically saying fingers up to you. So yeah, touche.
We'll show you that stamp. That's good. And then we have the station opposite and you see all the parades and people coming over. And it was just like, how tangibly do we tell that story on a group tour?
Yeah.
So 4 years ago, it was kind of like a vision in Tej. That was just like, it's hard. I can't work with anything.
So you guys have been working on this exhibition literally for 4 years then?
I'll tell you what happened about 6 years ago, almost to this day.
Yeah,
so 6 years, 2017. I emailed the palace. I didn't really know who to email. I just emailed a random email address. Because Aftar Bara had an image of the 23rd Sikh pioneers at Hampton Court.
Yeah.
So I emailed them, given that's the regiment of my great-grandfather.
Yes.
And I thought he might be in there. Because I actually didn't know how to recognize him initially.
Okay, I see what you mean.
I wondered if they had the names. In fact, they didn't really know anything about this. They knew something about the regiment, but they didn't have the names. So they invited me in, and two of the chaps, one called David Packer and another guy called Ian Franklin, who both now retired,
yeah,
took me to Home Park and mentioned that 23rd Sea Pioneers were actually one of 26 regiments here in 1902. There were 1,200 Indian soldiers here.
Wow.
And they didn't have the names, and I got them from the British Library anyway by then, that really was the beginning of this journey, because David just said, when he just pointed out Home Park, he goes, wouldn't it be nice, Tej, if there was some kind of board here telling people that?
The story, history
and,
of it, yeah.
And we walked back casually, and that really planted a seed in it. I thought, well, actually, it would be great.
Yeah, yeah,
because nobody here knows this.
No.
Well, and we'd just finished in 2018 interpretation board at Chelsea.
Yeah.
At the memorial. So Tej has got his idea of an interpretation board. We've actually proved we can do it.
And it comes together.
So he was saying to me, you know, if we could do a tour, we could get an interpretation board here and do the tours. And I was like, yeah, okay, but you know how hard it is to talk to a palace. You know, I've been working with Chelsea Hospital for 8 years before I got an interpretation board there. Yeah. And I was just kind of, okay, yeah, it'd be nice, but it's hard. And it's the other side of London.
Yep.
It's a palace that's got an entry to go into, £29 to come into. And then what happened? The stars started to align because we've now sown the seed in people's heads, right?
Yeah.
May 2021, I get an email. We've just revamped our website during COVID. Get an email. Hello, my name is Sakira. I'm working at Hampton Court Palace. We're looking to do some research into the Indian Army here. Do you think you can help?
Funny you ask, right?
Yeah, funny you ask, I said. I said it to Tej. I said, Tej,
you're up.
Yes, I said to Sakira straight away, and a whole series of Zoom calls started. And at that time, they were talking about an exhibition called Standing with Giants.
Which are those big silhouettes?
Big silhouettes. Right. They're now installed again, third year running. So they needed someone to design a Sikh silhouette to represent the Indian Army, because they didn't just want Tommy soldiers at Hamilton. They wanted to show that the Indian Army were here
as well.
So I said, that's a good idea. So again, Tej and Avtara wrote to them and said, look, we can design a Sikh silhouette. It's not hard, you know, for us. And that was what all the meetings were about, a Sikh silhouette. But
initially,
working with them, talking to them, actually building a relationship, then showing what we had.
Yeah.
Then Zakira took it up and put the kind of business case in for an exhibition. That's how it happened.
That's insane.
Interesting thing is, you know, we're called a little history of the thieves, right? We're like the 30th person you contact when you can't. So first you go to Guru Singh Sabha here, there. They wrote to everyone and no one replied by email. So literally we were the only ones who replied. You were around at the time, they would have found you, but you had a start.
I would have definitely passed them over to you guys. That's hard of my forte.
Zakira did say, even, you know, all the Gurdwaras that come up in the top 10, I think, just reply to your email every now.
Just check your inbox, right? It might be something worthwhile. There's so much I want to ask about how this exhibition got put together. But before we do that, I want to find out more about then the living conditions that these soldiers are enduring, or at least experiencing. Maybe enduring sounds a little bit negative. but you mentioned obviously that everyone's turned up. Soldiers, the horses, the washers, the barbers. Like, how is the... like, so who is organizing these people to come over, and how is it set up and structured, and what are the living conditions like for these people?
But you see, if we try and do this in each segment, the night and day two, then the night and then, because each scenario kind of differs, then 1937, 1919, well, the conditions and the environmental factors around it.
And are they at these different times all staying in Hampton Court?
Well, that's a good question, actually, because I'm going to come to that second one in a minute. In terms of a good example would be 1919, because there's a bird's eye view map of the structure of how they set the camp up.
Yeah.
So you would have, the first thing that we have to kind of emphasize is all of the soldiers, British and Indian, were in the park. Because some people have come up to me and they think only the Indians were in the park and the British soldiers were inside the palace.
Oh.
Actually, none of the soldiers were inside the palace.
Okay.
They were in the park, including the British soldiers. So you had British officers. So every Indian regiment had British officers. So your colonels, your captains, they were all British. So that was a sector.
Yeah.
Next to that was the Indian officers.
Yep.
Then would be the Indian other ranks, which is anyone who's Indian but not an officer.
Okay.
But Havildars, Naiks, Sepoys.
Okay.
So, and then you also had the camp followers.
Yep.
So they were kind of segregated like this, right? British officers, Indian officers, and then other ranks.
Yeah.
So that's the first point to stress. Second thing is, as you say, with all these followers, they were taken care of. They brought their own doctors, should be mentioned. We've actually got five doctors, an image of five doctors.
That's insane.
A mini hospital. That's actually on the bird's eye view map as well. Mini hospital, which is basically just the doctors with a problem with them. Probably a few stretchers. So they had everything. They brought everything with them. They just transplanted their life. You know, washing clothes, fixing clothes with tailors. Everything was there on the grounds, which sounds very convenient, but it also meant there wasn't a need to mix with the locals, which is also what they didn't want them to do.
Oh, okay. So there wasn't a need to do it. This brings me on to the next question in the list, which is how are these people interacting with the locals and how are the locals taking to these people? Because, like, even the experiences of my family in, say, the 70s, and I'm sure lots of people listening to this can relate, which is there's a lot of racism usually. But we're talking 1919, we're talking all over 100 years ago. But equally, there's a caveat to this, which they're soldiers. So there's a use for these people in that they are defending the empire and all of the positivity that goes with that in the eyes of the locals. But what's actually happening on the ground? And like, do they interact with locals?
Well, we can divide things by the camp because by the year. So they were here just briefly. They were here in 1902 for Edward VII coronation.
Yep.
1911 for George V.
Yep.
1937 for George VI. And in between for the peace parade in 1919.
Yeah.
The 1902 was the first time they were here.
Okay.
So that was a trial and experiment for even the authorities.
Everyone, yeah.
And what we found out from the newspaper reports in 1911 is... a decision was made in 1911 that we're not going to make the mistakes that we made in 1902.
Okay.
So it goes on. So what happened in 1902, it was a free-for-all, right, in the camps. So members of the public could come up and start talking and interacting and even try a bit of the food, and it caused offense because of very strict caste obligations of certain communities.
Offended
by that. So in 1911, they had this system where they had passes.
So actually the soldiers were the ones who were being offended, not the locals. Locals were actually intrigued then to an extent.
They were intrigued.
Because if they're coming over and stealing your food, but wanting to try a little bit.
Try a little bit.
Okay, so actually it was the soldiers who were like, yo, you need to keep these people away from us.
I don't know if it's the soldiers or the hierarchy.
Okay.
Because another, even more disturbing than that was, and it's reported in the newspaper.
Yeah.
Is a lady pulled the beard of a Sikh soldier.
To make sure it's real?
Maybe. I mean, it doesn't say, why.
Okay.
I don't know if they thought that they were exotic men from the East or not, what they thought, but and this did cause offense.
As though they'd never seen a beard before. But anyway, yeah, fair. Okay, yeah. Weird.
Which in those days, people did have.
Because there's always those British cartoons and they've got these huge moustaches and beards, right? But
so,
yeah.
And so therefore, in 1911, they had a more regulated system where they would be cordoned off.
Yeah,
you needed a pass to get in, and that was repeated in subsequent coronations.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
I think in those early arrivals, you did see them kind of like the images you see in France when the Sikhs are walking through Paris.
Yeah.
You see them walking through Hampton, and all the town have come out to see them, and the kids are looking up to the kind of the heroes, you know, and that's how it felt like in these images. We have them here, and the kids have certainly got that. Kind of look at these tall super warriors coming in, you know, marching through their town. And they're like little boy scouts looking up at them going, wow, you know, that's what you see in those pictures, really. It's kind of a reversal of how
you would
new
assume...
arrivals would be welcomed out there.
Yeah, because you wouldn't expect them to be on the roads being like, oh, hi, how's it going, right?
Yeah, exactly.
One question that I wanted to ask was, this, in 1919, when the soldiers are stationed, it's March, if I'm... correct?
No, August.
August. Okay. So this is after Julian Wallah Bhag.
That's right. That's a good point. Yes.
Now, I couldn't help, because I wrote an introduction for this, which was basically, and in it, it pointed out the month that they're stationed, which, as you corrected me, is August, which is after Julian Wallah Bhag. Now, my first question is, how fast did information travel back then? Because obviously, in today's day and age, when something like that was, the stuff that's going on in Palestine at the moment with the ongoing genocide, that information travels so fast because of the fact we have social media. Back then, we've got newspapers, we've got telegrams and information that's coming to you via boat or whatever, right? First of all, how does that does that information get to the Indian Army soldiers, and how is it relayed to them? And then secondly, does that actually change anything in stationing these people? Or like, as in, I guess what I'm asking is actually, does Jallianwala Bagh have any impact on these soldiers?
Well, I mean, they've come from, most of them have come from India, because they've already returned to India. Most of them have.
And they've returned after what, the First World War?
After the First World War. But actually, on that note, for example, the 1st Battalion of the 23rd Sikh Pioneers didn't come in 1919 because they were in the Army of the Black Sea.
Oh.
So not all regiments came in, because they were still deployed in, say, Mesopotamia or Northwest Frontier. Most of them did come. Some of them didn't. But let's assume that majority of them have come from India now.
Yeah.
They may have... I've gone with the assumption, which you shouldn't do, actually, is that they knew about Jallianwala Bagh.
Yeah.
But it could well be that they haven't come directly from India. Maybe they've come from Egypt.
Yes.
Maybe they've come from Mesopotamia directly to the UK. And therefore, they didn't know about it. But there was an assumption on my part that they've come from India. But that was not a simple case.
So we were talking about the fact that they were stationed in other parts of India. So they weren't even in the Punjab when they were in India.
Okay.
So the news
wasn't necessarily going to get to them. Yeah.
Because the British probably suppressing that news, right?
Well, I think that's the reason I asked, because in a lot of the newspaper reports of the time that you read about Jallianwala Bagh, they're published after. They're not published...
after the inquiry.
Yeah, they're
the
not
inquiry.
Published contemporary to April 13th or whatever the date is, 1921. And so that made me then question, if the information getting to the public takes so long, surely getting to the Indian Army is even going to take even longer.
It does feel like that.
However, at the same time, we know that places around Punjab, as soon as Jallianwala Bagh happens, erupt in protest. So Gujranwala, they rise up, and the British government, or the British Indian government, whatever, drop bombs on them, and that's in one of the parliament discussions. So I just wondered if that had somehow managed to trickle into the army. But from what I can gather, it doesn't seem
actually
to make much of a difference.
Now that you've said this, it just reminded me that actually there was a newspaper article which is actually linked to this, because there was an army, there was a commission at the time ongoing, and it was in the newspapers that the Secretary of State for India has asked whether they should ask Indian officers at Hampton Court, one of them, to join this commission to extract their views on how to deal with the volatile situation in Punjab.
Oh, wow.
I can share that article with you.
Yeah, please, that's interesting.
Because at the time, that commission didn't have representation from the Indian Army, not from Indian officers in the Indian Army. British officers, yes.
Yeah.
And the thinking in the article was, we've got these Indian officers here at Hampton.
Let's use them.
So shall we, there was a question, shall we use one? Even they had a decision hadn't been made to use one. They were asking amongst themselves, is it worthwhile asking one of them to join our commission to ask their views on the volatile situation in Punjab?
It's really interesting. It's really interesting. But yeah, no, thank you. It's just one of those questions that you're like, well, hold on, things are happening at the same time. Like, do they have any kind of connection? So these people are based in Hampton Court Palace. And correct me if I'm wrong, they're based there every time. 1902, 1911, 1919, in 1937? Okay. So what impact does that have on the wider kind of British Indian relations, but also kind of the socio-political landscape? Because as you said, like, first time they turn up, you got a lady or someone nicking some food, and so the second time they kind of change it a little bit. And by 1937, things are like, you're almost getting to the cusp now of the start of the Second World War and stuff like that. So like, how is these soldiers, these Indian Army soldiers, and I think it's a good point to make, which is they're not just Sikh soldiers. You've got Hindu soldiers, Muslims, Sikhs,
Gurkhas.
Yeah, you've got people who don't technically come from a particular religion and follow perhaps some type of caste or kind of village tradition. But how is their continual kind of arrival there impacting just the wider relations between Britain and India, and also just the kind of social landscape?
Well, understanding each decade has its own kind of characteristic story, doesn't it? Really, because in 1902, they arrive, and they weren't supposed to be here for as long as they ended up.
Oh, okay.
Well, they arrived.
Yeah.
And then the king has appendicitis. So the coronation gets delayed.
His coronation was delayed.
Yeah. So these guys then have to stay a lot longer than they planned to stay for.
And were they, I can't imagine they were happy, like the soldiers themselves were happy about it.
This is quite interesting. So there's an interesting article in one of the papers, and it shows a Muslim soldier at prayer, you know, in facing Makkah with the carpet and doing his prayers. And the caption is that he's praying for the king's speedy recovery so he can go home. You know, so I just thought that's quite like, that's they're stuck in a park.
Yeah, yeah.
6 weeks to 8 weeks longer than they planned. And then they're just staying there, you know. And the British government then decide that actually they need to go on a kind of tour of Britain. You know, kind of let's go and show them some places, you know.
Oh, and so okay.
So this is why then these soldiers end up all over the place. They end up going up to a...
In
1902.
It was Glasgow, Warwick.
They came to
Warwick Castle.
London soon. They were taking a trip to London in the car.
But this is interesting because I remember reading when I was putting together the video about the Khal Sajjad Thawaz Gurdwara.
Yeah.
And there's an article from 1911 or 1919 talking about they get Indian Army soldiers and they bring them to somewhere to celebrate Guru Gobind Singh Ji's.
So, should I...
That's a different one, yeah.
Shall I tell you this story?
Yeah, yeah, go for it.
So what happened in 1908, the students have come over, the five students from India. Yeah. They're just Singh plus four others.
Yeah, yeah.
They've come in, sent by Sant Atar Singh Mastan to establish Sikhi in the West via the student visa route, right? So they all come to the UCL, come to Cambridge, etc., but with the mission to establish Sikhi. And actually it's... 29th of December 1908. So in Caxton Hall.
That's where they did it. Yeah, yeah, it was at Caxton Hall.
But it wasn't those students who did it. It was a gentleman, a different gentleman, who was doing something about freedom fighters of India and took Guru Gobind Singh Ji as a freedom fighter of India and decided to celebrate his birthday at Caxton Hall.
Oh, interesting. I did wonder why.
He did it, and his name was Veer Savarkar who did it. So he was a student in London in 1908.
So I'm connecting that to the RSS and...
The movement that now the BJP, methodology. So in later life, he went to Mussolini, but as a student, he was trying to get the freedom of India and he was looking up to Guru Gobind Singh Ji as a freedom fighter for people's rights in India.
I wasn't expecting to find that out today. Like,
so he decided to just celebrate his birthday at Caxton Hall. So then the Sikhs turned up, those few Sikhs that were here in 1908.
That's insane.
And they had speeches and they had lapels and banners given out to people celebrating kind of independence and freedom.
Just go back to them, why he was doing it. What was he after? What did you say?
Freedom fighters. It's the early parts of the freedom movement for India.
Oh, okay.
So he took Guru Gobind Singh Ji as one of the three great freedom fighters of India, you know, for human rights and things like
Bloody
that.
Bloody hell, there's a lot that we could go with that, but that's interesting.
There is, that is good. That comes on my Caxton tour. But just a few years later, then we get to 1911. Yeah. And in the book about the Khal Sajjad Thawaz, there's an article from the Times. Now, we've all got that article from the Times. It says, a proposed Sikh church in London. Proposed Sikh church in London. And even before the Hampton Court connection, I didn't read that. It actually says, with Indian officers from Hampton Court. So the students needed a bit of backup.
Oh, I see.
So they were going to see the Maharaja of Patiala. They're not going to go on their own. They're students, right? You try going up to a Maharaja on your own. So I'll let you take over the story there, Tej.
Well, what we have in 1911, we have a... So if we go back to the article says a deputation of Sikhs from Hampton Court.
Yeah.
And in 1911, there's a group photograph of Sikh officers that you could tell they're officers because of what we see on the uniform. So the Subedar Majors.
Yeah, yeah.
This would have been the deputation of Sikhs. There's about 20, 25 of them in this postcard image. This would have been the deputation of Sikhs that would have pressed upon the visiting Maharaja of Patiala, Bhupinder Singh, together with the Sikh students to say, look, and by now it's the second trip to London because it's been in 1902.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, we've got everything we want.
We've got Gurdwara.
But what's interesting is in that postcard image of the Sikhs, I can identify, and some of us can identify, five of them, names and regiments. Some of them won, you know, Indian Order of Merits. They've been all over Africa. You know, they've been Northwest Frontier. They've got all six individuals have got very illustrious military careers, and they're here at Hampton Court in 1911.
So wouldn't it be fair to say that the first Gurdwara in the country wouldn't have been built if it wasn't for the Hampton Court Palace Indian Army being stationed there? Because what you guys are saying is that they are like the the final piece that pushes. So the students, I get it. Santej Jha Singh is obviously spearheading it.
Sure.
Santej Singh Ji has obviously sent
him.
They're
young students, right? I go to universities. I mean, imagine taking five students saying, go and meet a king and try and see if we can squeeze some cash out of him, right? So I just think having prestigious soldiers standing behind you, will you make your
But equally, Maharaj Bhupinder Singh, and this is obviously during the Second World War, he was very much willing to get his soldiers involved in, World War II, obviously. Yeah. So obviously there's going to be that connection as well, right?
Yeah.
What's interesting is with that donation that he gave is the value of it.
Yeah.
So in sterling, it was £8,000.
Yeah.
That's what the book says, 8,000. The time was 8,000.
But in rupees, it's sava lakh. It's 125, which is obviously a special number.
Yeah.
All right. So he gave a sava lakh
to
rupees. Yeah. Which is eight grand.
And how much, I doubt you guys will know this off the top of your head, but roughly how much would that be in today's money?
Well, I just go back to the 1970s and you could buy a house in East London for £2,000. So £8,000 in 1911.
Was it?
A lot of money.
A lot of money.
A lot of money.
And look where it was, Holland Park.
Holland Park.
So it wasn't Hounslow. So
That's insane. That's mad. So we've gone from Veer Savarkar doing a commemoration to Guru Gobind Singh Ji to basically the Indian Army being stationed at these points, helping to get the Gurdwara built. Mad. Okay.
That's where these little histories take you.
This is insane. Yeah, I wasn't expecting this when we were going to talk about the Indian Army at the palace exhibition, but no, okay.
And this is where everyone says it's the same Caxton Hall. Yes, it's the same Caxton
Hall. Yeah, it is the same Caxton Hall.
Where the Deep Singh had the Women's Parliament.
Yeah.
It's the same Caxton Hall where Maharaja Bhupinder Singh is on the steps with Sir Michael O'Dwyer. And it's the same Caxton Hall on 13th of March 1941.
Where mate, he gets shot. Yeah.
Right? So there's Sikh history at Caxton Hall.
I'm surprised it's not a good dollar.
Exactly. Just missing the Nishan
side. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
That's mad.
Just going back to a bit of the socio background.
Yeah, yeah, please.
1919, you mentioned Jallianwala Bagh.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But the other thing that's going around in 1919 is the Spanish flu.
Yeah, because it hits, the influenza hits Punjab. Is it the same year when it wipes out like 100,000 people or something?
About 20 times more mortality rate than the First World War.
Yeah.
And Punjab was, because the troops brought it back with them. So hence, it was a cascade effect. So they've come here from India with possibly, loss of many of their own relatives to the Spanish flu. Plus you've got Jallianwala Bagh.
Yeah.
So that's the context that we need to think about when we see 1,800 troops at Hampton Court. They come from a country where, in fact, their actual journey here was delayed by the Spanish. They were quarantined in either Suez or France. Hence, they missed the official parade with the British Army. They're supposed to take part with that.
Bloody hell.
But because they missed it, because they had to quarantine for 2 weeks, King George V then said, well, I still want you to, you've come all the way, so you'll have your own one. So it was 2 weeks after the main one.
And they had it at Hampton Court. Peace for a session for England.
But then insane. That took part in Admiralty Arch in central London.
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
Matt, okay, there's so much that we can...
Oh, so they had a practice at Hampton Court, and then they did the Admiralty Arch.
I'm not sure if they did a practice one at Hampton Court, but they took the main...
Oh, maybe that was sent a practice, because the pictures we've got are of the side of Hampton Court.
Right? Yeah, I think they're just parading. Yeah.
So before we just get into the exhibition kind of as an entirety, one thing that I would love to know, and this is more so to tease people watching or listening to this to actually come to the exhibition, which is there like one artifact or one story that each of you have from the exhibition that you think is worth sharing or something with that kind of just connects with you, say on a personal level?
I have a story of there's a image, there's a photo which I found here at the National Archives of my great-grandfather Subedar Major Bawa Singh, 23rd Sikh Pioneers. So we had that image as part of the exhibit anyway. But we were contacted, or rather Rav was contacted by email from somebody in India called Mandeep Singh Chauhan. And he recognized his own great-grandfather standing beside my great-grandfather.
We thought his great-grandfather and two people we didn't know.
His name was Subedar Amar Singh. So first,
what a great name,
what
right?
What a great name, right? It's meant to be. So firstly, that put a name to another person in the photo. But what he went on to tell us is that Subedar Amar Singh's father was also in the 23rd Sikh Pioneers 20 years prior and came to Hampton Court.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So he then showed me an image, a group photo of the 23rd Sikh Pioneers at Hampton Court, which we already had. We had that, and that's part of the exhibit. But then he pointed out which one's his great-great-grandfather, which is Amar Singh's father.
Yeah, yeah.
So we knew where he was sitting. So you've effectively got father and son in two photos at the exhibit. Bashitar Singh, Naik Bashitar Singh, and Subedar Amar Singh, father and son. And we didn't even know they were father and son.
Would they have ever seen action together?
No, because...
The age gap.
Yeah, the age gap.
Yeah.
And interestingly, Mandeep had a photo of my great-grandfather, which we didn't have. So there's a photo of Subedar Major Bawa Singh with a dog next to him and all his medals on, and with his bind at the bottom, and Banjoria and Jangpuria. And, you know, he's given me a good scan, but I'm still hopeful of getting the actual photo.
getting the original, isn't it? Original. Yeah, it's very different.
When we curate these exhibitions and we come up with these stories, I think for me, you know, having the Khalsa Sajatha book here and never ever paying attention to Hampton Court, but through the exhibition, Hampton Court, then the photograph, then the Sikh church, and then it's snippets of Punjab, New Zealand, the Sawa Lakh, and then Amandeep Madra picked up on that as well. And so, you know, all these little connections
come together.
Like, hold on, and now I've got a little clip in there and a little postcard. And suddenly I've got a whole story
of that one little thing.
When we do the tour, it's just like, actually, there's so much that story's come to life. And I think one of the other aspects that works for me in this, originally it was going to be one room.
Yeah.
Then it went to another room. And in the other room, they decided to have audiovisual, like a film being made. And with that film, the palace decided to commission a filmmaker. And then we did a worldwide call out in English and Punjabi, looking for descendants.
Wow.
You know, and it was amazing because I'll let Tej pick up, but I think through Tej, his networks, and this worldwide call out, we ended up with stories from each of the coronations and each of those events. So, right. Yeah, so they...
Vancouver to India, basically, and they've all been interviewed at the palace.
They all came...
They're the interviews you can watch.
Oh, wow. What was perhaps the most random country that one of these people came from?
No, it was Canada, India, London, all of them.
Oh, majority, okay. Yeah.
So basically either UK, Canada or
India.
Because they're second or third or fourth generation. Yeah.
As in there was no one like from Fiji or something?
No. Not yet. No, I think we ended up with hundreds of items being submitted through the call-up. But the problem is they don't link to Hampton. You know, to do an exhibition at Hampton.
Yeah, it has to be bang on. Yeah,
and that's why I found that a lot of my collection is that I've got interesting Indian Army items here.
But it's not necessarily
actually,
that.
Actually, when we went into those meetings, the way the curators work and the way the storytellers work, it has to link to spaces and connections. And that's where we were fortunate with Tej Bal's collection, which is Hampton, Ian Franklin's input, John Schaefer, was it?
John Sheaf.
His, you know, we were able to pick up Hampton through local collectors. And then the little bit of wider stuff is there. Even there, I expected like the Sikh church story not to make it, but it got made in because of the Hampton
it
connection.
That's how it got made in.
And then, so that's how, so every item then we walk around, it's been a journey of 2 years of evaluating that item and coming up with a story to put it in or out. And more got selected out.
Selected
in.
Okay.
Because of the space constraints.
You can only fit so much in. Okay, let me rephrase that question. If there was one thing that you could take and you could keep it from this exhibition, and this doesn't have to be just what's made it, it could be the stuff that you've had to kind of cut and it's not made the exhibition. If there was one item that you could keep and there would be no issues and you wouldn't be stealing it or whatever like that, right? If there was one item that you could keep, what would it be and why? Because I think that actually pulls the most interesting items out of the kind of the whole collection.
So for me, I've seen these items before through Tej because we've got such a close collection. You know, the medals I've seen before.
About 75% of it is mine.
Yeah. Oh, so you're going to keep it anyway.
So that's the problem.
But the one item for me is probably Sophia's pin badge, right?
And is it hers?
So what happens is there's a photo from the Museum of London at Haymarket, because we tell this story on the tour. She's standing there with the equivalent of poppies. They've got them sitting there and all their women's institute ladies and she's standing there. And that was phenomenal. They sold these elephants on a pin. It's a little pin badge with an elephant and you wear it like a poppy.
You've got an image of it on the website, on the Hampton website.
But there's very few that are left in the world, right?
I've never seen it. When I saw that photo, I was a bit like, this is new.
So it's on display, but selling those through their networks and through the princess and through the women and whatever they were doing.
Yeah.
What they were trying to do was the soldiers had come in summer uniforms. So this is 1914. they left India in August wearing khaki summer cotton shirts and arrived in September on the onset of winter.
Oh, yes.
So what they needed is heavier uniforms made like to European to withhold the
The
so winter. They did this fundraiser selling these equivalent of poppies. And they raised over £1 million. So they could actually
like
get
like £1 million at that time.
At that time, well, the equivalent of £1 million.
Right? That's still impressive, though.
And then they got organized and they sewed uniforms and they sent them to the Western Front so they could actually have some protection from the cold. You know? And this is being organized by women here, led by Sophia, who was campaigning for this, and her sisters, together with other Indian women here. And
what
together
what
with
year
their
is
mates,
this? 1914?
And the photograph's 1915, I think, in Haymarket.
So at the same time that she's fighting for suffragettes' rights, she's also actively supporting
Indian
the British Indian Army. And
100%. And there's another story that comes out of that.
Yeah, please go ahead.
Because should we go to, what, 1919?
That's right, we can do.
So 1919, these soldiers are at Hampton.
Yeah, the soldiers are at Hampton, as they were for the peace contingent. And what's emerged, in fact, two of our case studies are directly related to this. The Sikh soldiers of the 1800, of which maybe there's 200 or 300 Sikhs, they were invited and they went across the road to this Grace and Favour property where Sophia Dalip Singh lived, probably for tea.
Afternoon tea.
And there's a guest book, if you like. There's a guest book with names and regiments of each soldier. Who they kind of signed their name. And in fact, one or two of them signed it in Punjabi. So this came up in auction recently. You know, it's not part of our collection. Somebody else has it in Canada now. But it's fascinating to see that these soldiers came over to meet Princess Sophia Dalip Singh. And there's actual photographs in the garden, if you like, of the Faraday House.
Surely the British are seeing themselves though, connecting with Indian Army soldiers.
1919.
I was telling you about the daughter of...
Granddaughter, yes.
Ranjit Singh.
Like, have you come across anything that is kind of like we shouldn't be letting these people talk? Because surely that it could turn into a powder keg of its own.
Well, I mean, all we had is... so there's a lot of letters written by Sophia. We don't have... But nothing of that nature. Nothing, nothing political.
So she's very much...
I think it was just innocent tea. She was
kind of like my country folk.
Let's
Bindadagals kind of thing. Okay.
That's right.
So would it be fair to say then that, and this is not necessarily connected directly to the exhibition, but would it be fair to say with Dalip Singh's passing, the whole concept of ever trying to reclaim any ounce of sovereignty kind of went with him? Because it doesn't seem like his kids are that bothered. Or has the situation, it's kind of like, then
I don't think I don't think the boys were that much inclined.
Yeah, because Frederick, he's shooting and hunting and drinking and...
Yeah, so what was gambling in one
place? Having a great time.
Well, even with Dalip Singh, it came late in his life.
And it was a ploy to try and get more money, than ideological.
And I think his daughters, I think with Sophia, everything I read about her and in the Who's Who, I think of 1935... in the Who's Who.
Yeah.
You know, she could fill a page with Who's Who, right? Because she had that many titles and that many honorary things. And she was a kennel club member, a cyclist, keen environmentalist, women's suffrage. And all she wrote for the Who's Who was for the advancement of women. That's it. It's got Sophia Dalip Singh for the advancement of women. Nothing about being goddaughter, granddaughter.
I think that shows it very clearly,
So, and I think her sister Catherine, what she did with, the German refugee children, bringing them to their house in Penn.
She's the one who is in the lesbian relationship with the female partner, isn't it?
In Germany, they moved to Germany, but they smuggled them children,
and they helped
Jewish
so many
children. It's called the Sikh Schindler. So there will be films made about this in the future. I think, you know, it's just that obvious. And then Bamber. So I think Bamber, Catherine, and Sophia were more connected to Lahore and Punjab than the brothers were.
That's pretty fair.
And Bamber went back and spoke of herself as the queen of Lahore, right? And she settled there and she's there. So, but I don't think they actually claimed any kind of sovereignty. They would call themselves princesses of Lahore. You know, I am the princess of Lahore.
But I guess at that point, it's more of a
title. Yeah, it's a title there, So, and I suppose everything they had was kind of not formal. It was kind of at the mercy of the British government. Any kind of, because their father had the kind of entitlement, and then that kind of seeped away in the next generation. Yeah, no,
we should just add, though, in 1919, when they came over across the road to Faraday House to meet, that wasn't the first, our first interaction. So our first interaction was actually the pavilion in Brighton in 1915.
When they opened it?
No.
When the soldiers
were evacuated from the Western Front to be...
Oh, sorry. When they were put at the hospital. I thought you meant you were talking about the Kshatri, the white...
That came afterwards.
Originally,
when they were in the Brighton Pavilion, where they were being...
In the hospital, isn't it?
Right. It was converted into a makeshift hospital. So they used to send over people, like Indian medical students, to go and nurse these...
Soldiers. Yeah,
there is another story, isn't it? White nurses weren't.
This is the thing that white women were allowed to nurse Indian men.
And my question on that is, and I'm not surprised at that. My question is, who is that? Like the soldiers are like, we don't want white women touching us, or are the white women like, we don't want to touch these brown people?
I think it's a government.
I assume it's probably a government instruction.
Okay.
So one of these women was Sophia the Leipzig. She was trained as a nurse, and we know this because some of the soldiers wrote back to their families to say, we can't believe we've been visited by the granddaughter of the King Ranjit, and we're shocked that she speaks Punjabi,
which even
I'm shocked with.
When she came back from Lahore, it was one of the defiant things that Catherine Bamber and Sophia refused to speak in English to each other, kind of defying what Queen Victoria wanted, because she was the Empress of India. These kinds of stuff. They started, they learned Punjabi and Urdu when they were in Lahore, and then they only spoke to each other in kind of code, I suppose, when they were trying to.
I'd love
put
doing
it
this.
All right,
I love doing this. Yeah,
and she gave them a gift. Sometimes a pair of socks. Sometimes because this is all documented in letters.
Bloody hell!
They wouldn't use it. Like gifted.
Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna just like
that's it.
Frame
send it back to
put it on my wall.
So that second time they met in 1919. That wasn't her first interaction. Obviously, had that empathy for the Indian soldiers, particularly the Sikhs.
And before that, it was the Lascars. Before them, it was the Lascars. Always her countrymen from India.
And so what was she doing in relation to those guys?
The Lascars were coming over on ships, mainly from Calcutta, but Sikhs were coming onto ships from Calcutta and then on the trade routes with the merchant ships and all of that, coming into Blackwall. It was called the Blackwall because the walls were painted black, so you couldn't see what's coming in to try and steal the spices from India and all that.
The
Blackwall Tunnel is next to the Black Walls of the East India Dock. She organized, because basically what would happen, the ship would come in, they would then roam the streets of the East End or Hackney until the ship being to get ready to go back. And they would be just
stuck
in seamen's houses along the East India Road, basically. And I think she organized for a place for Indian soldiers where they could get their own food and all of that stuff. It's near, it's on the East India Road. There's a Holiday Inn or a Premier Inn hotel there now. So it's still a kind of a hotel respite. But it's like 110 years on from when she organized for that to be open. Because otherwise, you'd be just destitute on the streets around the East End.
So at the beginning, we obviously spoke about how the idea for this exhibition has kind of sprouted over the last 6-7 years or so. Now, I just want to get an idea more immediately. What was involved in putting it together? And how did you get it off the floor? So like, as in going from concept is fine, and I get it. You've had to do all these Zoom calls and make sure all the items connect and the stories and all, like a hell of a lot of work. But like, how does it go from that to...
Shall I pick this one up, Tish? Because I think from my side, we are the community curators.
That's right.
So it's our collections and our stories and the checks and balances that we do. Behind is the power of the HRP team, like Historical Palace. I think there's some emails with about 26 different people CC'd in. So you have Jatinda and Zakira. So Zakira's lead curator.
At the palace.
And she's already working on her next exhibition. So they don't even get to enjoy the exhibition. We're loving it. We're going like every twice a week, And Zakira's, oh, I'm sorry, I'm over here. Jatinda's the community producer.
Okay.
Jatinda works at the Tower of London, but she works at the palace on this
one. Nice.
So, and she's, she's been doing this for a long time. Then we've had Sophie on the media side. We've had Claudia on the podcast side. We've got the kitchen guy, Richard from the kitchens, who's coming up with all these stories of the food. We've got Sebastian. We've had Simran, Peter Vance's daughter, actually designed some of the maps.
Nice.
So when the palace put their effort behind it, you know, it's not just me and him working in there like all night trying to get
these things. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get out. Yeah,
you know, they've had a film made, they've had podcasts made, they've gone out to people and recorded Birdsong at Hampton and put that to the background of the letters. You know, we got letters translated by using community. And that's why it's been a bit more enjoyable for me. It's like, it's not like my tools where I have to do everything from the admin, the emails.
You've got a big team helping you,
WhatsApp,
in it.
I've actually worked out how we can just do our job and let the machine carry on moving, you know?
Yeah, we've between Rav and I, we've probably given majority of the collection there. So as Rav said, we're the community curators. But there's a big team from Historic Royal Palaces behind this, which without which, and they organized, they did everything. You know, we basically turned up to meetings.
Yeah, we turn up to meetings, we give our advice, but they do the procurements, the finance, the cost codes that generate the business cases. And literally, you know, it takes a long time and it takes a lot of meetings because, you know, you can't damage the floor, you can't do this,
well,
you can't do
that. You know? I have to
it's a historic padded.
I have to buy special padded things for my camera stand so that I don't damage the floor when I come on Monday, right?
Because if that scratches, they're left with the bill, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I'm not getting sued, I'll tell you that.
So all of this stuff, I've watched because we're all three of us here, we're micro businesses, right?
Yeah,
we do everything
yeah.
ourselves, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, we're growing. Like the first podcast I did with you, I showed you that we're bringing people in.
Yeah, yeah,
now we
completely.
Have 10 people on the tour team, 10 people on the author. But they're still all micros. We're all 10 micro businesses. No one's got access to a free photocopier or something, you know? We're all still doing it all ourselves. But the Palace, I think they've come into it wholeheartedly because of, it's their story and they want to showcase their story. And when I saw that actually it's not an exhibition about Sikhi, it's not an exhibition about Punjab, is it? I said, we're everything I would have, I was like, have this.
Doesn't necessarily
doesn't
relate.
Connect.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
that
yeah.
took me about 6 months to get my head down and look through everything again with a Hampton angle, you know? And now it's the producers, the events, the lectures we've got going on, inviting you guys into them. Actually today, not knocked back any idea we've asked for.
I mean, we just on that note, there's several outcomes of this, and one of them is the exhibition.
Yeah.
The other one is the silhouettes.
Yeah.
That's where we started. But the other one is actually, when I mentioned at the beginning, we've actually got an interpretation board now.
Yes.
Where David actually said, wouldn't it be nice? And now we've got one, which again was only unveiled.
Full circle,
exhibition.
The plaque and the interpretation board. I know I've got tours there. 2027,
definitely.
And that's permanent, you know. So the exhibition will probably come and go, but the board
will
is
be there.
And there's so many locals. Whenever I've gone, there's so many locals who walk their dogs. And they say, well, we've been here for 26 years.
We didn't know
the home park was used for. Because over the four visits, it's 4,500 soldiers.
A lot of people.
You got 1,200 in 1902. You got about 600 in 1911, 1,800 in 1919, and about another 650 in 1937.
Yeah.
So,
and just the Punjab being a large proportion of that, I keep saying to people, look, see, before Southall, we had Hampton. We had a pin or two ourselves, you know.
I like that. Yeah, yeah. You know? Where were Sikhs first settled in England? It's a trick question, isn't it? It's Hampton, mate.
It's in a palace.
I wanted to ask you something about the exhibition and it's now slipped my mind, which is so the only reason I ask about how much went into doing this exhibition is because I'm trying to guilt trip everyone listening to this or watching it to come to the exhibition. Because I think the thing is, and I'm of an age now where I vaguely remember the Arts of the Sea Kingdoms exhibition, but I really remember like the Golden Temple exhibition and the stuff the UKPHA did. And I think without things like that, the realization that I could do kind of, when I say do, micro businesses again, but like the reality that there is Sikh history or Punjabi history or however you want to define it, that can fill an exhibition or can fill a museum, was a game changer. Now, there's people like you and others who have been putting these exhibitions on and are still doing it. And it's amazing, but they're only worth it if people turn up. And I think that's one thing that I really want to stress to people listening and watching. And also the main reason why I wanted to come down and do the recording in person is because you guys are all doing the work and it's taken 6 years, 7 years. The smallest we can do as a community is to support you and however that is, whether that's turning up and going to the exhibition or doing a podcast
or sharing.
Completely.
You know?
So I want to ask you then, in terms of like, to give an idea to people watching and listening, is what can they expect at the exhibition? What are they going to see? What type of items are there? Like, how do you bring this exhibition to life? I know we've been talking about all sorts, but to give someone in a, I don't know, a couple of sentences, an idea of what they're going to be encountering without giving too much away, like, how is this exhibition being brought to life?
Okay, so we've got, you could divide it. It's a small, it's a relatively small space.
Yeah.
We've managed to pack in quite a lot. So you have, some of them are items of uniform, which would be worn at the time by some of the Sikh regiment.
And are they contemporary? So they are from the time. They're not like modern remakes or anything.
No, it's an original piece.
Okay.
Yeah. We obviously have several postcards depicting life at the palace, which could include laundry or even sports.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I had to do something with the time. We have several... last week, say, well,
no, we got. About... So I think videos are quite impressive. We mainly capture some videos in Hampton. So I think for me, it's like I've been to all the exhibitions you're talking about. You know, the V&L was a volunteer guiding people to the toilets, right? That's my main job in 1999. Then I went to all of them and the UK PHA's exhibitions. Bought groups there before I even started a little history, you know. And but for me, the difference here is they had big space and they had big,
like, it was a huge exhibition, massive,
know, and that was a different type of exhibition.
Yeah, yeah.
The difference here for me is, let's say for the exhibition, this is probably the first time you're going to hear Punjabi at the palace. We actually did sound recordings, reversed the letters back into Punjabi or the Hindi, recorded them with artists from the theatre academies. And then now that's when you go on Monday, you're going to hear Punjabi in a palace, right? You got the video room with the stories of descendants, because this isn't an exhibition about the palace. It's an exhibition about the Indian Army people at the palace. It's their stories, their descendant story. It's their experience, their cooks, their kitchen. It's about them. It's not about the king and queen came to visit.
Love it.
Because the palace has all their collection of the king and queen. Shook hands with this officer and shook hands with that one. So that, there's none of that in there. There's nothing from the palace in the exhibition apart from the pin badge from Sophia.
Yeah.
Everything else is from the community, about the people who came to that palace. And, you know, we had lots of meetings about how can we, you know, fit it into the future. You know, there was words used which didn't happen. They would wanted to bring women into those camps, and women didn't come to the camps in 1902 from India.
From India,
they wanted to bring their women folk.
No, because there was a kind of a hint that could there have been women?
No, for the palace team, they were asking us, you know, apart from all these men, would any women have come?
Oh, okay.
For example, the followers, the camp, the non-combatants, the dozens.
Yeah, or the whatever.
I said no, they're all men.
But
they were insisting that no, there must have been women. We're like, no.
Because, you know, there's, and all these little, they could get tense, but we tried to hold out.
But that's why the community curators come in, because you understand the culture, the religion, the setup, and the way things would have worked at that point, right?
I think so. And I think that's the video room. You know, people sit and watch the video, they can hear the sound, they can see. But I think for me, it's the special thing about this is someone said to us some feedback. They came on a tour, and I'll tell you something else. They said to me that, they said they were a very elderly couple. They came and, you know, we looked after them. And they were part of a big group and there was only two elderly. And they sat down after about 4 hours with us and they must have been tired. And he goes, I just want to tell you something. And I said, Chalo, Uncle, you bad.
I'll listen.
And he gave me his card and he's got the MBEs and all this stuff. And I don't know who he is, but he's a local. And he said, you know, in my time, I've been doing this and this and this. And he goes, I've been to Holland, I've met with the ambassadors, I do in London, I do the, and all this stuff about ambassadors. And he goes, you two have done something which the ambassadors haven't been able to do.
Yeah.
He goes, you have put our stories into their space. He goes, ambassadors meet the royal families, they meet the palaces, they go to these things 10 times a year, and they only talk about their stories. They only talk about India or Punjab. And you've actually put
it
in their space.
And,
you know, I thought, oh, and then he told you the same story 10 minutes later.
10 minutes later.
And then he went and told the next person and the next person.
So I just thought, you know, that's quite touching coming from him, because experienced it. And for me, that's an impact. But, you know, for me, we're still a little history. We still, what we have been given in this exhibition is curatorial rights.
Yeah.
So we organize Sikh Heritage Days, Punjab Heritage Days. I've got groups coming. You know, we've done 3 at half term. We were supported by Hounslow Gurdwara, way over the number I told them. They bought a double-decker coach. Punjab coaches came across the palace. Double-decker, 85 people got off that coach. They came in, the palace put on teas and coffees, hot drinks, rooms.
That's brilliant.
You settle in, you get our presentation in English, Punjabi, whatever you want, we'll do it. Then we take you to surprise if you want. We come back, we take you through. And then they get free tickets to come back for another time. So on my days, on Little History Days, it's free. I only charge on the website as a commitment to turn up because everyone books in and doesn't turn up. So we've had 85, 75, 65. So I'm confident through our previous work with the partnerships we've got. But, you know, I'm not asking Punjabi communities to turn up en masse if they really do find it a financial barrier. We have a lot of Sikh Heritage Days planned and we'll keep doing them. So you come in through us for free and we'll work something out with yourself where people, you know, genuinely, if they want to go, you'll save £180, you know, a family of four, you know, you'll save big money. But enjoy the day, enjoy the palace, and maybe then there'll be less. When it's a free ticket, the blood pressure's not that high. So I do free tickets to the Kohinoor through my tours.
Yeah.
And if I charge them £35 to see it, their blood pressure's quite high. They start
and they'll
swearing
definitely come up at least, all right? Yeah.
They start going, I'll start diamond and all this kind of. But when you got a free complimentary, I say, cut the swearing,
just
no anger, just turn up, appreciate the story. Appreciate what the palace have done to re-edit that story and present in a new
make
way.
Make it good,
And learn something and then write your books and make your films and do something in the future with this history, you know.
In fact, that was on one of the day excursions when they were waiting for Edward VII, where he had appendicitis. So one of the day excursions to fill up the time was Tower of London. And I'm pretty sure there's a newspaper article where the soldiers said, well, we want to take it back.
We'll take back to India.
I was just about to ask, surely these guys are like, what the hell is going on?
They went to Westminster Abbey as well.
Westminster Abbey, we've got images of them with on the banks of the Thames, sitting quite almost as if they owned
House
the
Lord.
I love it. Oh, this is that photo of the House of Lords where they're sat in, and you can see the river on this side. Yeah. Oh, I didn't realize that was from that.
That's a day
out. That's a day out.
Out on a jolly.
They had many day outs on the jolly.
Not bad.
All over, not just in London, but all over the place.
That's insane.
Woolwich Arsenal, Portsmouth, Southampton, Warwick, Birmingham. They went to the small arms, the factory where they make arms in Birmingham. I forgot.
Darlaston is somewhere like that.
Where they stamp the weapons. They went there to...
Well, penultimate question, and my last question about the exhibition at least, which is, how does the exhibition challenge or confirm historical narratives surrounding the Indian Army in England during the early 20th century? So I think modern narratives of colonial history is very, at the moment, very polemic. How does this exhibition either challenge these kind of misconceptions or confirm, how does this exhibition fit into the colonial era of the time? And what does it kind of say about the relationship between not just British and Indians, but also between soldiers and their superiors? Because there's obviously not just color, but there's caste, there's country, there's kind of the colonial occupier and the occupied. Like, how do all of those identities come together in this exhibition?
One of the ways that's manifested is if you look at the martial race theory, which really had its genesis in the mutiny and post-mutiny period. It was this theory where, you know, policymaking individuals in India had this idea that certain men can carry arms and certain men can't. And what happened in the 1902 coronation camp is almost this sort of experimentation with genesis and eugenics, where this ethnographic study was done on around 10% of the coronation contingent, around 156 soldiers from about 20 regiments, about six men from each regiment. They measured the heights and width of their head, width and breadth of their skulls, basically the heads. Calculated certain ratios for each caste, for each ethnic group. They determined what's called the cephalic index, where they divide the height by the width by the height. But they did it to determine the purity of each community. So they said, the Brahmins are very pure because their standard deviation is like minimum. Whereas other communities like Balochis and stuff, you know, even the Sikhs, you know, they're quite far from the standard deviation. So they've had more mixing. You know, this was done in the 1902 camp and published in the Royal Anthropological Institute carried out the study in one of the anthropological journals that was published, Journal of Anthropology. So I think, you know, that prevailing thought in that Victorian Britain of different communities, this actually determined their recruitment practices for different regiments. These communities can't serve with these communities, so we'll have separate regiments for them.
Well, I was reading Kushwant Singh's History of the Sikhs the other day, only to read the chapter about First World War and Second World War in order to try and prepare for this, right? Because like, my knowledge of this era is, it's okay, but you need to know what you're talking about, right? And he's saying that on the outbreak of the First World War, there's like 100,000 Punjabis, and correct me if I'm wrong, within the British Indian Army. But by like the end of 1915, that's risen by like 3 or 4 times the number, because they are just like, are you Sikh? Yeah, all right, let's go. So in a lot of ways, this theory, depends how you look at it, does the Sikh community favors, but also puts us at the front of fighting these wars.
We were disproportionately recruited, no question about that, given our ratio in the population.
Yeah, yeah, and that's something that's continued even now.
Yeah, yeah. It works both ways, it does, but the Sikhs, they get employment opportunities out of it. They get this career, military, even to this day.
And people get land grants, like you were talking earlier about land grants and stuff, like that's once you've served a particular, like how does it work? Do you have to serve a particular amount of time or...
Yeah, I'm not sure the specifics of it. I think maybe 20 years or something like that. Otherwise, people would drop out after.
Yeah. It's just impossible.
I'm not sure what the period is, but...
But there are
maybe
rewards.
You get more land or less land if you have some gallantry medals or something.
Okay.
But they did get a Jagir of land.
They did, probably
allocated to them.
We've displayed 1 or 2 pages of this paper at the exhibition.
Nice.
So,
well, I'm definitely looking forward to Monday because it's going to be a lot of fun. And equally, I have to say thank you for the invite.
So what they do is they do these press campaigns, and they did one in September, which we sent to you. But I said to them, look, I need to do something with the Punjabi media. And then obviously there was only, it's our journey as well with Little History. We're a little community now, you know. So I'd invited the ones who'd had the podcast with me and that. And to be honest, the big players don't. They won't put the time into.
Well, I'm always happy to support us, man.
Because I'm a cover brief.
Yeah, always here, man.
And then I said, look, that's my little group.
You don't even have to think about it. Yeah. I'm there. Just shadow.
And we are, you know, we are, Touchwood is going well.
Yeah.
You know, the palace are happy with how it, I think it's being absorbed here and in India and wherever else. And we, you know, there are negotiations going on now for the next one.
Nice.
So this is how it starts to grow, isn't it? You know, so not just for us, but
for everyone. A lot of this is dependent on the feedback we get from people who come.
Yeah.
Firstly, people coming and then giving good feedback.
Yeah.
And the palace will make a decision of, you know, how do we, you know, do we carry on? Do we, you know.
Do we do another one? Do we do something else?
Because ideally, you know, we saw that space before it was turned into an exhibition, and it was a quiet, redundant space for years. Now that it's been brought into an exhibition space, there's probably demands on it.
Yeah,
but we're kind of asking, why can't it just be permanent?
Yeah, it's a true point, especially if it was a bit of a dead zone before.
It's only Hampton.
You can't
take it to the Tower of London because it's Hampton
Court. Yeah, it's actually related to the actual place. No, touche. My last question. Are any particular Sikh histories, and when I say Sikh, it could just be like a Sikh soldier or a Sikh... Like, I'm really interested to find out about the Sikh dietary requirements and how that was all kind of...
Richard can come down.
How that was kind of managed and what their requirements were and how the meat was like... Did they literally have goats on site that they then killed themselves and ate? Or was the meat...
Shall I tell you another story?
Yeah, go for it.
This is another story, right? So in the Times newspaper, so you know Victorians have a central garden.
Yeah.
Right, it's gated and then all the houses around. You see this in Chelsea.
Yeah.
That's your communal garden in the middle, right? And then the houses around the outside and you all have a... Nowadays, you have a committee and a key.
Okay.
You know, so only the people who own flats
can access.
Come.
Yeah.
Actually, there's a story back into the 1911 days with these Sikhs, you know, from India. And whatever, they turned up at one of these gardens with a small goat in tow, performed a ceremony.
And had a great meal afterwards, right?
Right. And then the onlooking, you know, Edwardian families are looking over going, is not a communal space. This is our space. And that's the genesis of now, you know, residents associations having gated parts where only those communities can go. Before, they were more communal.
Love it.
Anyone could come in. But once these kind of unwarranted activities started to go on in, you know, by these turbaned people from India, you know.
Love it.
They suddenly decided in Belgravia that
No,
you'd have to have a key and a terms of reference. And
it might be a little bit traumatic for others, right? Watching such an incident like this.
I was finding that hilarious. Just before that, they were just gardens, communal gardens.
For that question,
which one?
Sikh histories.
Oh, because there is a poignant note here, you know. So, like you say, I mean, my origins are we called ourselves a little history of the Sikhs. And I didn't take the advice of a senior person you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had said to me, like, if you just call it a little history of the Punjab,
yeah,
it's a wider thing.
It's bigger catch.
But my reading was all Sikh history.
Same here.
So that's you're more comfortable. When you're a little nobody in 2012 trying to go onto Facebook, you know, I can't talk about Lahore and...
And it's comfortable as well, right? Like, we know it almost.
We kind of read enough to put ourselves out there on it. But he did say to me at that time, and I said, no, I haven't read enough about, you know, Islam or Muslim community.
Yeah, yeah, to know the nuances and how it works.
Yeah, but now, 10 years on,
it's different.
Kind of like we can understand and present and more confidently talking. But the exhibition is about the Indian Army. The Sikh stories have come through us.
Yeah.
But there are all the other communities are represented in there. Gurkhas will probably find it interesting to visit because there's some rare postcards on their histories and their forefathers. Because they were all part of the regiments as well. You know, and Punjabi Muslims. Oh my God, it's like 50% of it's Punjabi Musulmani Indian Army camps. And anyone that was dressed in regal headgear, they were the ones who were photographed. So Sikhs were photographed disproportionately more because they had a higher, taller height, you know?
That is the end of the Indian Army at the Palace Exhibition podcast with two of the community curators and organizers, Rav and Tejpal Singh. If you want to support the work I'm doing and see Ramblings of a Sikh grow, then consider becoming a paid YouTube member or join our Patreon community via the links below. Your support helps us produce content but also provide you with exclusive features, including early access to all our videos. Your contribution helps bring these stories and videos to life, and for that, I'm deeply appreciative. Remember, there is a super exciting behind-the-scenes video of the exhibition coming up very soon, so don't forget to subscribe. Otherwise, I'll see you all in the next video.